I want you to imagine, just for a second, that you're standing at a crowded bus stop. Or, maybe you're relaxing at a park and someone just casually leans over to you and says, "Excuse me, but there is an ant on your southwest leg."
It is such a wonderfully disorienting image, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, if you are a native English speaker, hearing that sentence would immediately trigger this frantic, almost comical mental calculation.
Right, yeah.
First, you'd probably look down, just, swatting at both legs just to be safe. But to actually comprehend the sentence, to know exactly where that ant is without guessing, you would have to find the sun. You'd have to look the shadows on the pavement. You'd try to establish like a compass direction in your head.
Maybe thinking about which way the nearest highway runs or where downtown is.
Exactly. And then finally, you would have to orient your own body within that invisible macro grid to figure out which leg is currently protruding into the southwest quadrant of the space you're occupying. It is a massive ex.
It requires a profound amount of mental gymnastics. You're basically demanding that your brain halt its normal operations, pull up a geographic map, sync it with your physical proprioception, and calculate an intersection. And yet, for a 5-year-old child living in the Porampurra community of Northern Australia, hearing that exact same sentence would trigger absolutely no mental gymnastics at all. For them, saying, "There's an ant on your southwest leg," is as effortless, as immediate, and as neurologically natural as you saying, "There's an ant on your left leg."
And that mind-bending reality of the fact that a 5-year-old can instantly access a spatial awareness that would leave most of us utterly baffled is where we're starting today. We are doing a deep dive into a 2026 paper by C.F. Deitz titled The Grammar of Language. And this isn't just, some abstract linguistic theory.
Not at all.
It's a comprehensive architecture that merges decades of empirical cross-cultural cognitive experiments conducted by cognitive scientist Lyra Boroditsky with Deitz's own philosophical framework, which is called the closure framework. And the core mission of this deep dive is to explore a concept that might sound like science fiction, but it is rigorously documented. The language you speak doesn't just help you communicate about the world, it actively, physically builds your reality.
It dictates how you perceive time, how you navigate space, how your visual cortex literally processes light and color.
And even how you assign moral blame.
Exactly. And the reason this matters so deeply for you, the person listening to this right now, is that the very words, the specific English grammar and syntax that we're using to construct this deep dive, are secretly filtering and building the world around you at this exact millisecond. You are inhabiting a cognitive architecture that you likely didn't even know you were trapped inside. To really grasp the gravity of Deitz's paper, we have to look at the historical baseline. Because for centuries, the dominant assumption in both philosophy and linguistics has been what we might call the label theory.
The idea that the physical universe is just sitting there, fully formed and
It's a tool.
prepackaged. The laws of physics, the dimensions of space, the flow of time, they just exist completely independent of us. And under that assumption, human beings just sort of wandered into this pre-existing reality and started slapping different vocal sounds onto things.
Like a grocery store.
Like a grocery store where all the cans of soup are identical, but the stickers on the cans are printed in English or Japanese or Swahili.
The label theory assumes a universal cognitive baseline. It suggests that underneath the superficial differences of vocabulary, every human brain experiences the exact same underlying reality.
But the research synthesized in Dietz's paper violently rejects that view, right?
It completely dismantles it. What Boroditsky's experiments began to reveal, and what Dietz's framework formalizes, is that language is not a passive set of labels. Language is a constitutive force.
Meaning it builds things.
Yes, it does not describe a pre-existing world. It creates the cognitive facts that you experience as the world.
Okay, let's unpack this, which brings us back to the most undeniable, immediate reality we all share: physical space. If we want to understand how a grammar constitutes reality, we have to start with how we exist in a room, how we orient ourselves. And that takes us straight to the Kuuk-Thaayorre language spoken by the Porampurra community.
Back to the ant on the leg.
Exactly. We mentioned that ant, but we need to explain why that sentence even exists. Because the Kuuk-Thaayorre language entirely lacks relative spatial terms.
And we should define what that means mechanically for the brain.
Yeah, please do.
So, relative spatial terms are words that depend entirely on the orientation of the speaker's physical body, left, right, forward, backward. These are profoundly egocentric concepts.
Because the spatial grid moves with you.
Precisely. If you are facing a tree, the tree's in front of you. If you turn 180 degrees, the tree hasn't moved an inch, but suddenly the tree is behind you.
Right.
Your body is the center of the universe, and your language forces you to dynamically update the spatial coordinates of everything in the room based on where your nose happens to be pointing.
But Kuktheor simply doesn't have those words. You literally cannot say, take a left at the river or, you know, step backward. You have to use a cardinal grid. North, south, east, west, and all their compound directions. Everything is anchored to the landscape, not the body.
Correct. If you want a Kuktheor speaker to move aside, you don't say step back. You say step a bit to the southeast.
I really want to try and visualize what this actually does to human cognition, because it's one thing to hear that as a fun trivia fact, but the implications are staggering.
Oh, absolutely.
Navigating the world with relative terms left, right, forward, back is essentially like walking through a pitch black room with a tiny dim flashlight strapped to your chest.
I like that.
That flashlight only illuminates what is immediately interacting with your physical body. My left, my right, my front. That is your entire spatial universe. But Kuktheor grammar, because it mandates the use of north, south, east, and west for the most basic interactions, it operates like a permanent, omniscient GPS satellite view locked into your brain.
What's fascinating here is that that is a highly accurate way to frame it, because it highlights the biological reality of what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. This isn't just a cultural habit or a neat party trick where they happen to be good at wilderness survival. We are talking about a fundamental rewiring of the brain's cognitive architecture, driven by the mandatory daily exercise of their grammar.
Wow.
Think about the cognitive prerequisite for speaking this language. If you want to say something as trivial as pass the cup, but your language requires you to say pass the cup to the north northwest, you must know exactly where north northwest is before you can even open your mouth.
Wait, so you literally cannot formulate a grammatical sentence if you lose your bearings?
Precisely. From the moment a Kuktheor infant begins to babble and acquire language, the grammar places a non-negotiable demand on their neural resources. The brain must allocate a massive amount of subconscious processing power to constantly track their absolute orientation in space at every single moment of their waking life.
That is wild.
And Buroditsky demonstrated the sheer power of this cognitive architecture by running a brilliantly simple experiment. She took highly educated Western academics, people with PhDs, brilliant scientists from Stanford and MIT, and put them in a closed, windowless room.
Okay.
She spun them around a few times and simply asked them to point north.
Oh, I would fail that instantly. Unless there was like a very obvious shadow coming under a door, I would be completely guessing.
And that is exactly what the academics did. They were utterly lost. When Buroditsky compiled the data, their pointing was basically random. They pointed in every conceivable direction.
So the flashlight was just spinning in the dark.
Exactly. But when she tested a five-year-old child from the Porampurok community, that child could instantly, without hesitation, point to true north.
A five-year-old?
Every single time. It didn't matter if they were inside a strange building, outside in the bush, or entirely disoriented by being spun around. The Kuktheor speaker possesses a spatial cognitive capacity that the English speaker simply lacks.
Because the English speaker has relative spatial cognition, while the Kuktheor speaker has absolute spatial cognition.
Right.
And what Dietz's paper stresses here is that neither of these is objectively wrong. The physical environment, the actual inexhaustible reality of the room itself, is identical for the Stanford professor and the five-year-old.
Yes, the magnetic poles of the Earth exist for both of them.
But the cognitive world they inhabit, the facts of space that they actually perceive and experience, are radically different. The English syntax forces an illusion that left and right are fundamental properties of the universe. The grammar constitutes the space.
It really forces you to confront the arrogance of our egocentric worldview. We assume left is real. It's not. It's a linguistic construct.
That is so true.
And if the brain's spatial map is this rigidly dictated by grammar, it opens up a fascinating logical progression. Because if your spatial map is anchored absolutely to the earth, what happens when your brain tries to process something invisible?
Like time.
Exactly. How does a brain with no concept of left or right even begin to organize an abstract concept like time?
Right, because you can't point to tomorrow, you can't physically hold yesterday. Time has no physical geometry, so human beings have to spatialize it in our minds in order to comprehend it.
Yes.
And this is where Boroditsky's experimental design gets incredibly clever, because you can't just ask someone, what shape is time? They'd look at you like you're crazy. You have to test it non-verbally.
Exactly. To bypass language and test the raw cognitive spatialization of time, she used a very elegant sequencing task. She handed participants a shuffled stack of photographs depicting a clear temporal progression.
Okay, what kind of photos?
The classic example she used was a sequence of an apple being eaten. So one photo shows a whole untouched apple, the next shows the apple with a single bite taken out, then a half-eaten apple, and finally a photo of a bare apple core.
Got it.
She handed these mixed-up photos to people from different linguistic backgrounds and just asked them to arrange the photos in chronological order on a table in front of them.
Now, for an English speaker, the results are entirely predictable. If you hand me those photos, I am putting the whole apple on my left, and I am arranging them in a straight line so that the apple core ends up on my right.
Almost universally, yes.
Mm-hmm.
English speakers arrange time from left to right.
Which tracks perfectly with our writing system. We read left to right, we write left to right. Our eyes are trained to consume information in that direction, so it feels inherently logical that time flows in that exact same direction.
And that hypothesis, that reading direction dictates temporal spatialization, is perfectly supported when you test speakers of Hebrew or Arabic.
Because they write right to left.
Right. Those languages are written from right to left. And when Boroditsky gave them the exact same shuffled apple photos, they arranged them from right to left. The whole apple went on the right side of the table, and the sequence moved across their body to end with the core on the left.
Okay, so far this is interesting, but maybe not world-shattering. It just proves that our physical habits, like scanning a page, bleed over into our abstract concepts. But we are setting up a collision course here with the Cook Theor, because if they literally do not have the concepts of left or right in their cognitive architecture, they can't arrange time relative to their body at all.
That was the exact puzzle. How do you map time if your entire reality is anchored to a cardinal grid? Boroditsky found that the Cook Theor speakers arranged the photos from east to west.
Wait, so the timeline doesn't sit relative to their body at all. It's physically anchored to the compass points of the room they are sitting in?
Yes. It is completely independent of the observer. Think about the mechanics of this. If a Cook Theor speaker is sitting at a table facing south, east is on their left and west is on their right. So facing south, they will arrange the apple photos from left to right.
But if you ask that same person to get up, walk to the other side of the table, and sit down facing north,
suddenly east is on their right and west is on their left. So without even thinking about it, they will take the exact same photos and arrange them from right to left.
Oh my God.
If they sit facing east, they will arrange the photos so the timeline comes straight toward their chest. If they sit facing west, they will arrange them pushing away from their body. Time is locked onto the cardinal grid of the physical landscape.
That is just, it breaks my brain a little bit. For an English speaker, time is like a suitcase we carry around with us. It's always bolted to our body. No matter which way I turn, the past is always hovering on my left and the future is hovering on my right.
Right.
But for the Cook Theor, time is a physical feature of the earth itself. They are just moving through it. The direction of time physically rotates in front of them depending on where they are sitting.
It reveals how profoundly our grammar limits our imagination. We assume our horizontal, body-centric timeline is the only logical way to perceive reality.
Yeah.
But it's just one specific linguistic architecture.
Wow.
And this spatialization of time gets even more intricate when Dietz's paper looks at massive global languages.
Oh.
Let's compare English and Mandarin.
Mm.
English grammar exclusively forces time onto a horizontal axis.
Yeah, our metaphors are entirely horizontal. We talk about pushing a deadline back. We say we are looking forward to an event. We imagine a long weekend stretching ahead of us.
Exactly. But Mandarin grammar frequently employs vertical spatial metaphors to organize time. In Mandarin, earlier events are described using the word for up, and later events are described using the word for down. The sequence of time flows vertically.
Okay, I hear you, but wait, when I say I'm looking forward to the weekend, I'm not literally hallucinating a horizontal timeline floating in the air in front of me.
Right.
Isn't that just a dead metaphor? It's just a turn of phrase that we've all agreed upon. How do we actually know that a figure of speech changes the physical way a Mandarin speaker's brain processes the concept of time?
That is the crucial skeptical leap. It is the exact question that critics of linguistic relativity have raised for decades. They argue that these are just poetic quirks, you know, surface-level idioms that don't affect actual cognition.
Yeah.
But Brodsky didn't just catalog metaphors. She tested the neurological processing speed behind them using priming experiments.
How exactly does that work? How do you prime a brain for time?
You take advantage of how the brain groups concepts. In a lab setting, Brodsky could sit an English speaker in front of a computer screen. First, she would flash a spatial prime, a visual arrangement of objects. For example, a row of dots arranged horizontally across the screen.
Okay.
Then, mere milliseconds later, she would flash a true or false question about time. Something simple, such as, does March come before April? The participant just had to hit a button for true or false.
So the idea is that the visual cortex is warmed up with a horizontal image and then immediately forced to do a temporal calculation.
Precisely. And she measured the reaction times down to the millisecond, which she found was undeniable cognitive friction.
Really?
Yes. When English speakers were primed with a horizontal spatial arrangement, they processed the temporal questions significantly faster. Their neural pathways were already aligned with the horizontal architecture their grammar uses for time.
Oh.
But if she primed an English speaker with a vertical arrangement, a stack of dots going up and down, and then asked the exact same question about March and April, their reaction time measurably slowed down. The brain had to fight through the mismatch between the vertical visual prime and the horizontal linguistic software it uses for time.
And if you run that exact same neural gauntlet on a Mandarin speaker,
the results perfectly invert. Mandarin speakers answer those temporal questions significantly faster when their brains are primed with vertical spatial arrangements, and they suffer that cognitive friction, that measurable slowdown, when primed with horizontal ones.
That is the smoking gun. It proves we aren't just talking about poetry, we are talking about synaptic firing speeds. Your brain is a piece of hardware, but it is running linguistic software.
Exactly.
If your software is Mandarin, time is quite literally processed on a vertical neural architecture. If your software is English, it runs horizontally. And the ultimate takeaway here is that time itself, the abstract physical dimension of time, has absolutely no spatial geometry. Time doesn't go left, it doesn't go down, it doesn't go west.
Right.
The physical universe just provides a raw sequence of events. It is the grammar of your specific language that constitutes the physical geometry of how your mind is allowed to interact with that sequence.
It builds a cognitive fact out of an abstraction.
Mm.
But what makes Dieth's framework so compelling is that it doesn't stop at abstract concepts like time and space.
No.
No, the paper pushes us into territory that feels deeply uncomfortable because it moves away from the abstract and straight into raw biological sensory input. Let's look at the biological act of seeing color.
Okay, this is where things get really wild because space and time are invisible, so it sort of tracks that we need language to organize them. But vision feels like objective biology. Photons hit the retina, signals go to the optic nerve, the brain registers color. End of story.
That is the assumption. But if language can draw hard boundaries in an invisible concept like time, what happens when a grammar attempts to draw boundaries across the continuous electromagnetic spectrum of light? Brodsky investigated this by looking at the Russian language, specifically focusing on how Russian categorizes the wavelengths of light that English speakers simply group together as blue.
Right. In English, the category of blue is massive. The sky is blue. A navy suit is blue. A robin's egg is blue. We might throw an adjective in front of it, light blue, dark blue, but cognitively, they all belong in the same bucket. It's all just blue.
But Russian grammar does not allow for that single bucket. The Russian language mandates a hard, non-negotiable boundary within that spectrum. They have a specific word, sini, which encompasses darker blues, and they have an entirely separate word, goloboy, which encompasses lighter blues.
Right.
And it is crucial to understand that these are not just variations of a theme. In the Russian cognitive architecture, sini and goloboy are as fundamentally distinct from each other as red is from pink in English. You wouldn't call a stop sign dark pink.
I think we need a physical analogy to understand what the language is actually doing to the light. Think about a rainbow or just the physical science of a light spectrum. It is perfectly continuous. There are no black lines painted between the colors.
Exactly.
It is exactly like a slider on a DJ's soundboard, smoothly and infinitely moving from one frequency, one wavelength to another. Nature did not put a dividing line between light blue and dark blue. The photons don't care.
The physical reality is a continuous gradient, but Brodsky wanted to know, Does the Russian grammatical requirement to divide that gradient into two distinct linguistic categories actually change how the visual cortex physically processes the light?
So how does she test it?
She set up an incredibly rigorous matching experiment. A participant would sit at a screen, and three blue squares would appear. One square on top and two squares on the bottom. The participant's only job was to press a button indicating which of the two bottom squares exactly matched the top square in color.
Mechanically, that is a pure vision test. It's a simple matching game.
Very simple. But the genius of the experiment was in the exact mathematical shades of blue being displayed. In some trials, the two bottom squares were both shades that fell firmly into the Russian category of Cine 2 dark blues.
Okay.
In other trials, the two bottom squares straddled the linguistic boundary. One was a shade of Cine dark blue, and the other was a shade of Gully Boy light blue. But here's the critical control factor. The objective physical distance on the light spectrum between the two bottom squares was always kept exactly the same.
Wait, so the eyes, the actual cones and rods in the retina are doing the exact same amount of biological work in both scenarios. The gap between the colors is mathematically identical.
Exactly. And for English speakers, the reaction times reflected that mathematical reality. Their reaction times were identical across all the trials. It didn't matter if the shades crossed the Russian boundary or not, because to an English brain, they were all just slightly different shades within the single bucket of blue.
Right.
But for the Russian speakers, the results were astonishing. When the two bottom squares crossed the Cine Gully Boy boundary when one was light and one was dark, the Russian speakers' visual processing spiked. They discriminated between the colors measurably, significantly faster than when both squares fell within the same linguistic category.
See, this is the epistemological crux of this entire deep dive, because the Russian grammar isn't just giving a handy vocal label to a difference that everyone organically sees. The grammar is creating a perceptual fact in the brain of the speaker.
Yes.
It is physically altering the speed at which the visual cortex discriminates between photons.
And we are talking about neural firing speeds measured in milliseconds. The brain is sorting visual data into linguistic buckets before conscious awareness even kicks in. Because the Russian brain has been forced to respect that boundary between Cine and Gully Boy every single time the speaker communicates, the visual system itself has become hypersensitized to it. The continuous soundboard slider of the physical universe does not come pre-divided. The grammar divides it. What is cognitively, biologically one single color in English is literally, tangibly, two separate colors in Russian.
Which is terrifying, in a way, because it makes you wonder what else we are physically blind to. What other nuances in the physical world are we entirely missing just because English hasn't built the architecture for us to see it?
Exactly.
And if grammar can draw arbitrary lines in a rainbow and physically change how our eyes work, how does it draw lines in human behavior? Because this is where Dietz's paper transitions from cool cognitive science into something with severe real-world consequences. How does syntax shape our judgments of right and wrong?
This brings us squarely into the domain of causation and agency. How do different languages encode the mechanics of an event, specifically accidents? English is a highly, almost aggressively agentive language. Our grammar is obsessed with causality.
Meaning, our sentences inherently demand to know who did it. We need an agent acting upon an object.
Exactly. Yeah. English syntax naturally assigns a direct cause to an effect. If someone is walking through a room, bumps a table, and knocks over a vase, an English speaker witnessing that will almost universally say, "John broke the vase."
Right.
The grammar demands a subject who performs a transitive action on an object. But if you look at Spanish syntax, the grammar handles accidents in a fundamentally different way. It's largely non-agentive. A Spanish speaker describing the exact same accidental event would likely use a reflexive construction. Translated literally, they would say something closer to "the vase broke" or "the vase broke itself."
It effectively removes the human agent from the direct line of causality. Now, Dietz's paper notes a very famous real-world example of how English speakers intuitively understand the danger of this agentive trap, even if they aren't trained linguists.
Yes, the Dick Cheney incident.
Right. The incident where former Vice President Dick Cheney accidentally shot his friend, Harry Whittington, during a quail hunting trip. And to be clear, we are looking at this purely as a structural case study of how language is manipulated under extreme pressure, focusing solely on the grammar. We're obviously taking no political stance here.
Of course not. It is an incredibly revealing linguistic moment.
Yeah.
When Cheney had to speak about the incident publicly, his natural English instinct to use the standard agentive format "I shot him" was completely blocked by the political and legal reality of what that syntax implies.
Because in English, I shot him strongly implies intentionality.
Exactly. The grammar doesn't cleanly differentiate between an accident and a targeted assassination. But English syntax doesn't easily allow for the Spanish reflexive construction either. You can't just say the gun shot itself or the man got shot without sounding absurdly evasive in English.
So what did he do? He built a grammatical labyrinth.
He had to. He strung together a highly unusual sequence of clauses and displaced agents to acknowledge his proximity to the event without grammatically owning the direct causative action.
Like what?
He said things like, "Ultimately, I am the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry."
Wow.
Notice the diffusion of agency. He doesn't say, "I shot Harry." He says he pulled a trigger. The trigger fired a round. The round hit Harry. It is a masterful, desperate attempt to force English grammar to behave like Spanish grammar. It perfectly highlights how rigidly English wants to assign a direct agent and the immense cognitive gymnastics required to circumvent it.
So what does this all mean? We understand the structural difference. We know English says John broke it and Spanish says it broke. But does that grammatical difference actually change the reality of the memory?
That's the big question.
Yeah. If an English speaker and a Spanish speaker both watch the same vase fall, does the Spanish speaker actually remember the event differently? Do they judge it differently? Or are they just using different words for the exact same memory?
Brodsky designed an experiment to test exactly that distinction between just talking differently and actually remembering differently. She showed groups of English and Spanish speakers a series of videos.
Okay.
The videos showed people doing things like popping balloons, breaking pencils, and spilling drinks. Crucially, some of the actions in the videos were clearly intentional. A person looks at a balloon and deliberately jabs it with a pin.
Right.
But other actions were clearly accidental. A person reaches for a napkin and inadvertently knocks over a glass of water. After watching the videos, the participants were distracted and then given a surprise memory test asking them to recall who was in the videos.
Let me guess. Because English grammar forces you to say John spilled the water, the English speakers remembered the people in the accident videos better.
That is exactly what the data showed. For the intentional actions, both the English and Spanish speakers remembered who did it equally well. Both grammars encode intentional acts similarly. But for the accidental actions, a massive divergence occurred. The English speakers remembered who caused the accident with a significantly higher degree of accuracy than the Spanish speakers did.
Because the Spanish grammar, the water spill doesn't require the brain to encode the person as the cause of the event.
Right. The Spanish grammar constitutes the event differently. In the Spanish cognitive architecture, the person standing next to the spilled water is not the agent of destruction. They are a patient of circumstance. Something happened to them.
Wow.
But because English syntax forces you to encode the agent in order to even describe the event, the English-speaking brain hyper-prioritizes remembering the identity of the person involved, even when it was a pure accident.
And this cascades directly into morality. If your brain is structurally wired to hyper-focus on remembering exactly who was standing next to the vest when it fell, you are naturally, inevitably going to assign more responsibility, more fault, and more moral blame to that person.
Yes.
The English language structurally primes its speakers to be more punitive toward accidents than the Spanish language does. The linguistic difference is not just changing memory. It is literally altering the moral reality of the event.
It is staggering when you consider the downstream implications. Think about our justice system. Think about eyewitness testimony. Think about how we conduct international diplomacy or assign geopolitical blame. The grammar we are using is not a neutral vessel. It is an active participant in shaping the assignment of guilt.
Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of ground. We've explored this incredibly rich empirical data from Boroditsky. We have seen that language alters the reality of physical space, the flow of time, the biology of color vision, and the morality of accidents. But the burning question that remains is why? What is a mechanical engine behind this? If language isn't just a set of labels, what exactly is it? This is where we bring in the second half of the source material, C.F. Dietz's Philosophical Architecture. Dietz provides the framework to explain the mechanics operating behind the curtain of all these experiments. It's called the closure framework.
Dietz's contribution is vital because it moves us from observation to theory. Dietz argues that a linguistic grammar operates as a closure regime. This is a concept borrowed from system theory.
Okay.
Essentially, a closure regime is a mechanism that organizes chaos into order by doing three very specific things. First, it draws distinctions. Second, it establishes identity criteria. And third, it maintains lawful relationships among the elements it has defined.
I think we need to break those three things down because that is a very dense academic definition. Let's start with draws distinctions.
Drawing a distinction is the act of looking at a continuous reality and carving a boundary into it. It is exactly what the Russian language does to the color spectrum. The reality is a continuous gradient of light. The Russian grammar draws a hard boundary, a distinction, between Sinikiny and Golubovoy. It creates two things out of one continuum.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the second part establishes identity criteria?
Identity criteria determine what counts as the same thing over time. Think about the English word river. You can look at a river in the spring when it's raging with snowmelt, and you can look at it in the late summer when it's a muddy trickle.
Right.
The physical atoms of the water are completely different. The shape is different. The sound is different. But our grammar provides an identity criterion that tells our brain this is the same river. It forces continuity onto a reality that is constantly in flux.
And the third part maintains lawful relationships.
This is the syntax. It's how the defined objects are allowed to interact with each other. This is the English agent of demand we just discussed. If a vase falls, the grammar maintains a lawful relationship that dictates there must be a subject, a person, who acted upon the object, the vase. The grammar writes the laws of physics for the sentence.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I want to offer an analogy to tie this all together. Visualizing a closure regime can still feel a bit abstract.
Let's hear it.
Imagine that objective reality, the entire physical universe, all the colors, all the time, all the space, the inexhaustible chaos of existence is a massive, endless ocean. Now, imagine that your specific language, your grammar, is a fishing net that you cast into that ocean. The size of your net, the thickness of the ropes, and most importantly, the specific size and shape of the holes in your net dictate exactly what kind of fish you are going to catch.
That is an exceptionally precise analogy for Dietz's framework.
The fish that you catch, the ones that are successfully pulled up onto the deck of your boat, those are what Dietz calls constituted facts. Those are the distinctions, the identity criteria, and the lawful relationships that your language actually allows you to perceive and process.
Yes.
But inherently, a net is mostly empty space. Water passes through, sand passes through, small fish pass through, and all the things that slip through the unique holes of your specific net, that is what Dietz calls the remainder. The remainder is everything that your grammar leaves outside its cognitive scope.
If we apply this net analogy directly to the experiments we've discussed, it clarifies the mechanics perfectly. The Russian grammar's net has a very fine, specifically shaped mesh designed to catch distinct wavelengths of blue. The Sinikiny versus Golubovoy distinction is a constituted fact pulled onto the deck of the Russian boat.
But the English net has a larger, looser hole in that exact section. That specific color distinction slips right through our net. The inability for an English speaker to instantly perceive those two blues as fundamentally different is English's chromatic remainder.
And it maps perfectly onto space, too. The Kukthayor net is woven entirely out of absolute cardinal coordinates. Their constituted fact, their daily catch, is knowing exactly where true north is at every given second.
Right.
The English net simply doesn't have the structural integrity to catch that kind of spatial awareness. The fact that I don't know where southwest is right now without doing a bunch of mental math, that blind spot, that empty space in my net, is my spatial remainder.
And this is where Dietz's theory becomes profoundly important. Dietz emphasizes that we cannot view remainders merely as missing words or empty voids.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the remainder of one language is very often a positive, vibrant, fully realized cognitive fact in another language.
Yes.
The absolute spatial grid is a real piece of cognitive reality. The two blues are a real piece of biological reality. They are genuine experiences of the world that one language simply cannot access because of the shape of its net.
Which opens up a truly dizzying perspective. Because if every single language catches some facts but fundamentally misses others, what happens when we zoom out? What happens when we look at the entire globe all at once?
This leads us to the formal theorem at the very heart of Dietz's work, detailed in a companion paper called Semantic Remainder. It is known as the language uncertainty principle, and it states formally that no finite linguistic closure can minimize both definitional remainder and contextual remainder simultaneously.
Okay, let's unpack that. It means there is a hard, unavoidable structural trade-off in human cognition. You cannot build a magic fishing net that catches absolutely everything perfectly.
Exactly. It is a zero-sum game of cognitive architecture. If you design a language to be incredibly precise in one specific area, for example, if you build a net with tiny, tight mesh to catch the absolute spatial grid of Kuuk Thaayorr, you must inherently sacrifice precision in another area.
Like your net becomes too heavy or too small to catch other types of contextual meaning?
Exactly. Every single time a grammar buys cognitive sharpness in one domain, it incurs a debt, a cognitive remainder, in another. And right now, on Earth, there are approximately 7,000 spoken languages.
7,000 different fishing nets cast into the ocean.
Yes. 7,000 uniquely structured closure regimes, which means there are 7,000 distinct, fully functioning cognitive universes operating on this planet right now. Each one minimizing different remainders, each one constituting a uniquely shaped reality for its speakers.
So logically, this raises the ultimate philosophical question. If we were somehow able to combine all 7,000 languages, if we could merge every single net together, overlaying them to cover all the holes, do we finally get the truth? Do we finally pull up the whole objective picture of reality?
This is a beautiful, tempting thought, a kind of linguistic omnipotence. But Dietz's mathematical logic says no. And this is perhaps the most profound point in the entire framework. Dietz introduces the concept of M. M stands for the inexhaustible ground of reality. It is the raw, vibrating physical universe before any language, any human perception touches it. And Dietz argues that even the sum total of all 7,000 languages combined does not equal M.
Because even a supernet made of 7,000 layers of mesh is still fundamentally a net. It is still a mechanism of closure, which means it still has holes.
Precisely. The very act of drawing a boundary, which is what language is, guarantees that something is left outside the boundary. The remainder generated by language points beyond itself to a reality that is fundamentally uncatchable.
Right.
As the old philosophical adage goes, the map is never the territory. Every grammar, whether it's the hyperagent of English, the vertical time Mandarin, or the absolute space Kuuk Thaayorr, is just a map. It approaches the inexhaustible world, it organizes the chaos beautifully so that we can survive and communicate, but it can never, ever fully capture the territory.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started with the jarring realization that a 5-year-old in Australia constantly tracks the cardinal directions, proving that an entire spatial universe can exist outside of our narrow concepts of left and right.
Yes.
We explored how Mandarin speakers physically process time on a vertical neural architecture, while English speakers process it horizontally. We examined how a Russian speaker's visual cortex literally reacts faster to shades of blue because their grammar created a physical boundary in the electromagnetic spectrum.
And we uncovered how the English need for an agent can literally shift our memory and aggressively assign moral blame for accidents.
Exactly. And we tied it all together with Dietz's closure framework, the realization that our languages are nets, catching constituted facts and leaving behind an infinite remainder. The grammar of our language is the invisible architect of our minds.
And this realization brings us to a final thought, a rather urgent implication that I think we need to leave hanging in the air.
Let's hear it.
We now know, both empirically through Borodisky's data and philosophically through Dietz's framework, that the 7,000 languages currently spoken on Earth create 7,000 entirely unique cognitive universes. Each one holds perceptual facts, ways of experiencing space, time, and morality that the others literally cannot see.
Right.
But we are currently moving at light speed into an era of instant AI translation, a highly globalized, increasingly homogenized internet culture. And in this digital, globally connected world, English syntax and Western logical structures overwhelmingly serve as the default underlying code.
So English is becoming the default net.
The default net. So we have to ask ourselves, as these smaller, uniquely structured languages face extinction at an unprecedented rate, are we risking something far greater than just a mass extinction of vocabulary? If we lose a language, we are not just losing a quaint, alternative way of speaking. We are actively collapsing an entire, irreplaceable reality. We are destroying one of the 7,000 cognitive universes. And once that specific net is gone, the constituted facts it caught, the unique ways of seeing time, space, and color may slip into the remainder, lost to human perception forever.
It is a heavy, beautiful, and urgent thought to end on. To you listening, the next time you speak, the next time you write an email, or even just think a thought to yourself, I want you to take a second and notice the hidden architecture of the words you are using. Feel the boundaries of your net. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We will catch you next time.